Ready?
You're rolling.
Frank Borman, we got well acquainted with you during the Gemini program when you and Jim Lovell set all endurance records in Gemini 7, and now you're the command pilot again on Apollo 8. How do you feel about this big mission and this lunar voyage?
Well, I think as you get closer to the mission, you get more anxious about completing it and about starting it, and you really get more more interested in the mission, if that's possible. The closer you get to it, the more you want to fly it.
Is the actual mission going to be a relief after all this year or so of preparation?
In a sense, it is. I think the greatest relief and the greatest feeling of accomplishment comes after the mission has been completed. And frankly, that's a very important part of the whole thing, is the sense of accomplishment of having done the job well.
I think I've heard you say that your greatest moment of accomplishment is when you climb aboard the carrier knowing it's been completed.
That's right, that it's all wrapped up.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you from originally in the United States?
Well, I was born in Indiana, but I really I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and I call Tucson home. I haven't been there. I've been in the away from home since I was 18 years old, and so I guess really now I'm a Texan. We've lived here in Houston for going on 7 years.
And where did you receive your engineering training?
Well, I went to school at West Point, which is the military academy in the United States, and then I took a master's degree at California Institute of Technology out in Pasadena, California.
Was that in aeronautics?
Aeronautical engineering, that's right.
And you were in the Air Force for a time?
I'm still in the Air Force. I'm a colonel in the Air Force. I'm working for NASA.
Okay. And how long have you been here in Houston?
7 years. Going on 7 years.
This is home for you and the family.
It really is.
Now,
we love it here.
Tell me about your wife and children.
Well, I married a girl from Tucson, and we have two boys, 15 and 17, Frederick and Edwin. And they're quite active in things other than spaceflight. Neither one of them has an interest in flying, even. They're quite different than their father. Yes.
I understand that your two sons are bigger than you are, Frank.
I don't know. I don't know what happened. My youngest one weighs 190, and the oldest one is 200. So I have to be very careful around the house now.
Well, one of the requirements for astronauts is that you be somewhat slight of build. And
neither one of them will make it.
How tall are you, and how much do you weigh?
I weigh about 165, and I'm about 5'9".
That means you will have plenty of space to move around in there in a space.
That's right. Well, the Apollo is quite roomy, as you know. We flew for 14 days in Gemini, which is about the size of the front seat of a Volkswagen, so we're looking forward to a lot of luck. Perhaps you could equate this to a Rolls Royce and the roominess.
When you're not flying, when you're not working on a space voyage, what are your other interests? What do you like to do?
Well, one of the problems with this business is that when you're working on a mission, or even it seems since Gemini 7, which has been 3 years now, you're so involved in what you're doing that you don't have time for much else. And this is one of the things that is kind of uncomfortable about the business.
But that's true throughout this community in which you live, too, isn't it?
It really is, although I think that perhaps the crews themselves get more deeply involved and in a more intense effort over a longer period of time. There are a great many people here, though, that are in the same, that for 5 or 6 years have not had the luxury of much recreation, and they're not all in the flight crew area.
How do you feel about the future of space programs and your future in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration?
Well, I've always tried to put blinders on. I've got a job now, and all I want to do is write down and complete this mission successfully. And I try not to allow myself the luxury of thinking ahead or planning ahead. I'll determine that when the time comes. Right now, I want to fly this one properly.
Good luck on it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Frank Borman. This is Rhett Turner.
I'm rolling.
Frank, during the last minutes of the countdown, you and Jim Lovell and Bill Anders are aboard the spacecraft. The preparations, the days, the weeks, the years have been completed. Tell us what you will be doing and what your thoughts are there during that final few minutes.
Well, the last few minutes of the count finds a crew rather inactive, actually. And perhaps it might be more interesting if I just took you along on the launch. So we've been in the spacecraft now approximately 2 hours and 40 minutes. The ground crew has been going through their checks. We've pressurized the spacecraft. We're sitting on top of 6.5 million pounds of vehicle, I guess 5 million pounds of fuel, on the order of 5 million pounds of fuel. About 9 minutes before launch, we hear the engine start. Excuse me, I said 9 minutes. I meant about 8 to 9 seconds before liftoff. We hear the engine start. They're quite loud. We feel a very gentle motion now as we lift away from the tower. And the motion is at first rather slow. And it builds up slowly. We have a very heavy vehicle, 6.5 million pounds of total weight, 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Now, about 11 seconds, we're at 11 seconds into the launch, and we feel a rotation as the whole vehicle rotates to assume the proper direction for the launch azimuth. At 42 minutes, we...
Second.
At 42 seconds, again, I keep slipping seconds to minutes. At 42 seconds, we change the mode of our abort. Jim Lovell is throwing two or three switches, and I'm reporting a Mode 1 Bravo. A minute and 50 seconds into the flight, we've passed the most critical portion of our launch. Really, at 117 seconds, we went through the high dynamic pressure region. It's around 40,000 feet, and now at a minute and 50 seconds, we're feeling more relaxed. The G's are building up. We're feeling 4 G's on us, which is the maximum we feel during the flight. And actually now it's a rather much of a pleasant ride. At 2 minutes and 0 seconds, the inboard engine on the Saturn V cuts out, and the G's drop off.
That's the center engine in the cluster of five.
Center engine in the cluster of five. We lose 1.5 million pounds of thrust. At 2 minutes and 26 seconds, all the remaining engines on the Saturn 1C cut out, and we have a staging. The five engines on the S2 take over, and we're now propelled by our second stage. Now at 3 minutes and 7 seconds, Jim Lovell is looking over all the instrumentation. He gets a go from the ground and a go from me, and he triggers off the escape tower. We will have no more need for this during our launch, so the escape tower is gone. Now, from 3 minutes and 7 seconds to around 8 minutes and 21 seconds, we're just sitting on the S2, 1 million pounds of thrust, and actually achieving our orbital altitude. Mm-hmm. Around 8 minutes and 21, 8 minutes to 40 seconds, the S2 cuts off, and we stage, and we're now on the S4B, which is the single-engine vehicle that we'll stay with for about 3 hours, in the order of 3 hours.
You're into Earth orbit now.
We're into Earth orbit. And after we achieve Earth orbital velocity, the S4B cuts off, and we're now in an attitude hold motion going around the Earth for 2 times before the S4B relights.
You mentioned this crucial point at 1 minute 17 seconds, this point of maximum dynamic stress
pressure
on the
mm-hmm.
vehicle. Describe what's happening at that point.
Well, at that point, the drag, or the forces, the aerodynamic forces pulling the vehicle back, are at a maximum. And of course, if you're looking for structural failures or any sort of buffeting problems, you expect to find it around maximum dynamic pressure, or max Q, as we call
mm-hmm.
it.
Is there the most vibration and shuddering at that point that you would experience?
Yes, you get the most buffeting at that uh-huh. point. And then, of course, as you go through that point, you exceed the speed of sound, and everything gets quiet.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather like sitting on the end of a needle.
Mm-hmm.
And
the sound's going behind you, so you don't hear
right.
it up ahead.
That's right.
Is it? Is this quiet? Does this quietness come upon you suddenly?
Yes,
during
it
the
does.
Booster?
It does. It comes upon you quite suddenly as you exceed the speed of sound.
How did that feel for the first time in Gemini 7?
Well, it was. By the time we'd simulated this so many times, we were quite ready for it. And of course, it's something we had expected, and we've experienced in airplanes.
Then after you're in Earth orbit with the S4B still attached, the third stage of the Saturn V rocket, then you begin that Earth parking period and prepare
right.
for the moon.
That's right.
Thanks very much, Frank, for describing these first minutes of launch.
You're welcome.
Frank, during the lunar orbit period, that is going to be one of the most exciting things we here on Earth will be watching with you. How do you feel about this part of the flight?
Well, of course, the 20 hours that we spend in lunar orbit will be the high point of the flight, and this is the real reason we're undertaking the flight, is to achieve lunar orbit and learn something about the Earth's, or the Moon's gravitational field. It's going to be the most active portion of the flight.
What are you doing as the commander as you go into this lunar orbit insertion?
Well, my primary responsibility will be to position the spacecraft so that Jim and Bill can undertake the task that they have. Jim primarily concerning navigation and lighting effects, and Bill photography and specific scientific observations.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Frank.
You're welcome.
Okay, now we go. The reentry to Earth, and that's going to be the most exciting yet in all manned spaceflight because of the speed at which you'll be coming back. Describe that for us, Frank, and how you feel about pulling this off.
Well, about 2 hours before the 400,000 foot mark, 400,000 feet above the Earth, we will orient the spacecraft so that we're in entry attitude, which will be heads down, blunt end forward. We're going backwards. And then about 18 minutes before we reach the 80-mile or 400,000-foot mark, we'll get rid of our service module, which is the rocket fuel and the large rocket-carrying part of the spacecraft. So now we'll be flying around in a vehicle that looks rather like an ice cream cone, and we'll be coming in blunt end forward, heads down. As we intersect or as we run into the atmosphere at around 36,000 feet per second, which is rather swift, we'll not only increase our temperature, but we'll start to pick up the several times the force of gravity. And the first pulse will slow us up. We actually take a spike, as we call it, or a large force, and then this slows up, and we the gravity or the G's bleed off, and then we build them up again. So it's really akin to riding a roller coaster. You mm-hmm. hit the bottom twice.
What are you as commander doing during this period?
Well, hopefully all I'll be doing is monitoring the performance of the automatic guidance. If the automatic guidance should not check out or if it should exhibit a malfunction, then I'll take over and control it manually.
Good luck. We'll be waiting to see you on that carrier.
Thank you very much.
Frank, this is undoubtedly the most ambitious manned space flight in history, Apollo 8. You're going at a time which is quite significant to one great part of the world, Christmas time. I'm sure you and Jim and Bill must have had many thoughts about your role as human beings in this program and at this time of the year. What do you think about this personally? What does it mean to you?
Well, you're right. We have had thoughts about it, serious thoughts, and I think that Jim and Bill and I all hope that this view of the Earth as a rather remote and compact disk that we hope to televise back on Christmas Day will in some way help the people that live on this sphere of ours to realize that there, although there may be national differences and boundaries and so on, we're really undeniably tied together, and I hope that in some way that this might lead to a feeling of cooperation and trying to understand and live in harmony with the other people around us.
You certainly are calling upon the support of many people in many lands to help you go there, to the moon.
I really look upon this mission and the scientific probes that are going from all the countries as an international effort, because we have the support of people all over the world in this, and much of the information that has been gathered in the Soviet flights has fed into ours and vice versa. So I think that this field that we're in may ultimately prove to be the field that binds people together, and I hope that this flight will highlight that.
You're quite active in your own church and your own religious beliefs, and you're also participating in the forefront of man's quest for knowledge. Do you ever find conflicts, or do you find resolution in the things that you learn the farther you go?
Well, I certainly don't find any conflicts. My idea of the Supreme Being, of course, shows he has no limits, and the things that we're doing are very insignificant to the things that are left to be done.
Do you feel that when you go into space and look back?
Well, certainly. I'm sure that in 50 years or 100 years, people will look back on this as not a very significant achievement.
Good luck, Frank Borman. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.